On this week's 51%, a program allows some women to keep their babies in prison.
I think we're the only maximum security prison with baby gates.
There's an online course about human trafficking, and a musician explores her Finnish past. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. A pregnant woman in prison typically has 48 hours with her baby after it's born before it's taken away. But the mother-infant relationship can play a critical part in a child's development. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports an opportunity in Indiana offers a mother a chance to care for her child in prison.
Kanan will be a year old next month.
He's 24 pounds now. Yeah.
He's been breastfed since birth. He's healthy and strong. His mother, 35-year-old Clarissa Clements, was pregnant when she was arrested on a drug charge.
I mean, I had to stay on hydrocodone the whole time I was pregnant because of being on the heroin that I was on so that I wouldn't have a miscarriage.
She was offered an intensive drug treatment program at the local level, but she'd heard about another option, one where she could keep her baby in prison. The Wee Ones Nursery Program started in 2008. More than 175 babies have been born and then raised in the cell block.
Here it's just me and him. He's got his own bed, and then I have my bed in here, and then we have a closet, and then we've got a bouncy seat and some toys.
The intimate prison nursery offers an opportunity Clemens says she likely wouldn't have on the outside.
To be able to bond with the child, you know what I mean? Because at home you'd have to work, you'd have to leave him, you know what I mean? And here, I mean, you pretty much spend all day with your child.
Experts recognize parent-infant attachment as an important part of a child's development. It allows children to realize their needs are going to be met, which gives them a healthy start.
Right now, we have 15 pregnant offenders on the facility camp.
All pregnant offenders in Indiana are sent to the women's prison on the west side of Indianapolis. Leah Hessian runs the prenatal program at the prison.
We have such strict
prerequisites for the women to come to this program, so the majority of them are not able to because this is...
Women who get to keep their babies must not have any violent offenses, their release date must be at most 30 months out, and they need to meet medical and mental health assessments.
I think we're the only maximum security prison with baby gates, but, you know, especially as they're learning to walk and crawl...
The number of women prisoners is rising around the country. Around 80% of women in prison are mothers. Hessian says children of incarcerated parents are 6 times more likely to become offenders themselves.
So what are we doing to bring these families together and to make these individuals feel that they have a valued role in society and that they are accepted back into society?
She says the difference can be made in social support, community resources, health care, education, and an opportunity to be with the newborn.
There is a change in the person, and that's a change that we can't necessarily always facilitate in a GED class or a business technology class, but it absolutely goes into returning law-abiding citizens.
Women in the Wee Ones program have a recidivism rate of 18% compared to 35% statewide. They also leave the prison with a wealth of information about healthy starts.
What is SIDS? You know, a lot of these ladies, they don't know. This may not be their first child, and it may not be their last. But these informational pamphlets about safe sleep, American Lung Association, talking about even secondhand smoke.
And the program helps more than just the mothers and the babies. In the baby dorm, nannies who also pass the criteria are allowed to live and help raise the children. Tina Baxter has nannied for baby Kanan since he was born. She has a son of her own on the outside.
Not that I don't remember. I don't think I took time to appreciate the little things that my kid actually, when he was growing up, like I do now that I'm sober and can appreciate those things.
She could be released early next year.
I think, though, this dorm has helped me realize how much I'm missing out on, especially when you're watching these kids grow, you know.
Baxter says she'll take the lessons she's learned in the nursery with her when she leaves and tries to rebuild her relationship with her son. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
This story was produced by a partnership between the Indianapolis Recorder and Side Effects Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. A new online course is available on human trafficking, and it's being offered by the UMass Amherst College of Nursing. Donna Sabella teaches the course. She's Associate Professor of Nursing and Social Justice. 51%'s Paul Tuthill spoke with Sabella about the offering.
And actually, I'm from the Philadelphia area, and I'm a mental health nurse. I was working in Philadelphia at a number of our drop-in centers. My background is mental health, and I realized in working with some of the clients at our drop-in centers that a number of the women had been trafficked. And in Philadelphia, we have a lot of good resources for mental health and addiction, but we had nothing for women who've been trafficked or any kind of trafficking at that point. So I went online, did some research, found a really good program in Phoenix, Arizona. I pestered them to let me come and look at their model. It was residential. And they finally agreed and went out there, collected information, did some research, went back to Philadelphia, where I started. I was a co-founder with a couple other people for a residential treatment program in Philadelphia called Dawn's Place. So that's how it sort of came about. We you know, got the clinical piece of it, and I thought, well, you know, a lot of people do not know what this is to treat it. And at that point, I was teaching at one of our state universities in Pennsylvania, Kutztown University. And I went to my department chair and said, listen, can I do this? And she said, absolutely. And I said, and I'm only going to do it if we do it, number one, online, and if it's open to everybody from I don't care where or what discipline. This is just not unique to nursing. And she said, again, absolutely. So we opened a section for the course. It was Introduction to Human Trafficking. And by that afternoon, that course was filled, that section. So we opened two sections. And I had students from all disciplines, from a couple of countries. So that's how I got started. I was teaching two sections of human trafficking every year. And when I left Kutztown, the program closed, I just kept taking the course with me.
And you've been at UMass Amherst since when?
I started there officially the 1st of July of 2016. So I first offered the course in the fall semester of last year of 2016.
And what's the response been like? A lot of people sign up for it?
Well, it originally didn't get much press because I was new. Now, before I came to UMass, I was teaching at Drexel University in Philadelphia, where I actually had a human trafficking certificate. So they really hyped that up, and you know, I guess maybe Philadelphia is a bigger city than Amherst. So, I mean, I had actually the three courses for the human trafficking certificate, and in addition to the certificate, I also taught different, you know, other sections if you don't want a certificate, and I taught in another school as well as nursing. So we're a little slow to get started at UMass, which is fine. You know, I'm have been there as long as I was at Drexel. One of the things that complicate, I mean, these courses are not inexpensive, to be honest with you, so that's a bit of an issue. The other thing as well, too, is that we're getting more students this year. But we're, you know, again, putting out more public relations and letting people know that we have something because it's many programs don't offer it. So making people aware of that is you know, but we're making progress. We've gotten more people this year than we had last year.
Why are you interested in this? How did you become an expert?
I became an expert, as I say, because my background is mental health nursing. And, I mean, there's a big component. Certainly there's physical components to any kind of trafficking. But the more difficult to eradicate and take care of, and often the more hidden aspect of this is the trauma and the mental health or the mental health issues. And this is just an area that, you know, I wasn't looking to do this, but it was just in front of me. And as a nurse, I knew I had the resources and the ability. And when you say you're a nurse and you want to help somebody, that usually opens doors. So, you know, once I got started on that path from going to Philadelphia to Phoenix to doing work and to be involved in research with their programs, coming back to Philadelphia, as I say, there was a need. And it just sort of grew and grew from there. So I've worked with victims. I'm a co-founder for the Journal of Human Trafficking. And, you know, I mean, it's once you dip your toe in the water for a lot of things, you just sort of continue along those lines.
Is human trafficking, is it pretty much the same everywhere, or are some parts of the country more susceptible than others?
That's a good question. It varies. It depends on what's going on. For example, if we look at sex trafficking, oftentimes, you know, if there's a big sporting event, you're going to see an increase in sex trafficking for you know, areas that have maybe Super Bowl. Or if there's sometimes they look at if there are certain military bases or conventions. And, you know, pimps and traffickers will know that. So you're going to take the women, girls, boys, men to where these events are taking place. In terms of labor trafficking, again, it depends. Is it time to pick crops? You know, there's little of that probably in the desert because there's no need for people, farm laborers. But if you're talking about an area where, you know, they need people to plant crops, et cetera, or there's a lot of restaurants or whatever, then, you know, then you'll see things increase and change. So it's always a fluid situation. Numbers go up, they go down, and people travel.
Where can people find out more about this? Now, you said the course is not just for nurses, not just for healthcare professionals, right?
Exactly. And I tell you, my background is interdisciplinary. For example, you know, I don't believe in sort of, oh, this, I'm this, and that's the only thing I am. My first degree is in Portuguese. I lived in Brazil. And so I believe in interdisciplinary. The course is open to, we actually have a public health student in there. In past courses, I've had economics. We've had law enforcement, teachers, social workers. I had the assistant district attorney of a county in Pennsylvania auditing the class. It's open to anybody. It's all online, and you have usually a week at a time to complete the work. You work at your own pace. There's also, I mean, again, I'm a good resource, but the government also has, if people go online and they look at human trafficking, Google that. The government has a wealth of information there, too. Polaris, P-O-L-A-R-I-S, is another excellent resource. It used to be Polaris Project, and they dropped the word project. But if people just Google Polaris, you'll find a lot of, you know, good information. Shared Hope. So, I mean, you know, it's too many to list, but there are places if people are interested. And it's not difficult to comprehend this material either. So, you know, anyone who's motivated can you know, find information for themselves. Many places, perhaps each county or parish, has a coalition, an anti-trafficking coalition that people can join. There are webinars, there are shows on TV, there are books, there's articles. There's my journal, Journal of Human Trafficking, which there are a lot of free articles people can have access to. You don't have to pay for it, although we'd be happy if you wanted a subscription. So, you know, a lot of resources out there, a lot of information.
That was Associate Professor of Nursing and Social Justice at UMass Amherst College of Nursing, Donna Sabella. She was speaking with 51%'s Paul Tuthill about her online course on human trafficking. Finnish immigrants to Minnesota often face discrimination, and many were radicals. To avoid the dirty Finn label, some Finns shunned their heritage. Diane Jarvi, a third-generation Finnish-American, makes music that embraces her under-celebrated culture. And in this profile of Jarvi, KFAI's Ryan Dawes explores Finnish history and music.
I'm Ryan Dawes in Minneapolis. When Diane Jarvi was a kid, living in Columbia Heights, she took family trips up north to Duluth and the Iron Range to visit her Finnish-speaking relatives.
They felt like they were from another planet sometimes. I mean, as a kid, you don't have the language. And that's what's been always frustrating for third-generation Finns, and is that we don't have the language. So then how do you make connections?
To answer that question, Jarvi bridges the gap through music and poetry.
Oh, Nilta, tähten sytty loistamaan.
I'm haunted, but it's not necessarily in a bad way. It's just, it's my DNA speaking through the arts.
But embracing one's Finnish heritage wasn't always a good idea. Finnish-American history reveals why. Modern immigration of Finns to Minnesota began during the American Civil War, before Finland was even recognized as a country. It was actually part of the Russian Empire at the time. Finnish immigrants settled as farmers and worked as miners across the northern U.S., especially in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and in Minnesota.
Terve, minun nimeni on Marianne Vargelin. Hello, my name is Marianne Wargelin.
Wargelin is a researcher and honorary consul of Finland. She says that during the early part of the 20th century, Finns became known as radical activists, organizing in temperance, socialist, and labor movements.
because they were part of these strikes that were taking place, they were also then becoming people who were blacklisted.
Even if they weren't part of these movements. Jarvie, the musician, learned this while digging through her family history. Her father worked for the FBI just before World War II. There, he discovered that agencies kept files on many Finns, some of whom were family friends.
And he was a file clerk, and he went through the files and went, well, I know all these. This is, you know, this is Joe down the street. I mean, this guy is not a communist. Just a guy, you know, who's a Finn.
And you will hear lots of stories about people who grew up on the Iron Range, particularly being told, you're some dirty Finn. And it was a question of, do I dare to even admit that I'm Finnish to anybody?
In repressing their heritage, some Finns even changed their names or spoke other languages to blend into other cultures.
And those people who were Finnish, who were Swedish speakers, because Finland had two languages, many, many people chose to disappear into the Swedish components of the Minnesota population. Because it was safer there if you were thought of as Swedish rather than Finnish.
Two generations later, Finnish Americans like Jarvie safely embrace their heritage. Jarvie sings in Finnish and plays a Finnish lap harp called a kantala, with a wild origin story that begins when a magical Finnish bard named Väinämöinen struck a giant fish with his boat.
He killed the pike, ate it.
Of course.
Took the jawbone and strung it with the hair of a demon's horse, which of course he just happened to have. And that was the first kantala.
Here she plays a song from the Kalevala, a Finnish epic collection of charms, chants, and poetry. In this song, Väinämöinen sings into existence a birch tree followed by the stars and the moon. And this one, called Nukumati, borrowed from the indigenous reindeer-herding Sami people of northern Scandinavia. It's about a sandman needed to lull kids to sleep during the long summer days up north. Jarvie doesn't take a purist approach, but rather draws the culture of Finland into her diverse work as an American songwriter, reinventing Finnish traditions, messing with the melodies, blending them with tango, jazz, and other genres. But more importantly for her, it's about reaching through the language barrier and the generational divide.
One of the reasons I started performing Finnish music or singing it was I did not know my grandmothers. You know, all my grandparents came from Finland, and I never met them. They died before I was born, and I felt like in some ways it's this conversation I'm having with them. It sort of spurs me. This kind of like, are you listening? Are you out there? I mean, it's tradition bearing in a sense, but it is connection to ancestors.
For KFAI, I'm Ryan Dawes.
We now bring you sports commentary from Dr. Keith Strudler of Montclair State University in New Jersey. Strudler discusses the efforts by famed skier Lindsey Vonn to race in a men's competition.
Perhaps the most painful athletic experience of my life came throughout college track in something called interval work, where we'd run a set of repeats of a certain distance, say 400 or 800 meters, and do it over and over again at an uncomfortable pace. That usually ended with most of us lying down on the track in some kind of listless agony before we went out to jog a few miles to cool down, such as the virtue of youth. While these track sessions were training, not races, they still held a competitive quality. Everyone wanted to enforce their place in the team hierarchy, even if it technically meant nothing. So, say you were the third best miler on the team, you didn't want the sixth best miler on the team to finish ahead of you. That relative order was enforced through a general unwritten code. In other words, you didn't try and show up the star of the team. And if you did, you were accused of leaving too much on the track at practice, which should be saved for when it really matters, like at actual track meets. It's all part of the odd set of relationships that maintain the fragile construct of team, one that could implode in any moment. For example, when women entered the mix. Allow me to explain. Every so often, our coach would create a mixed-gendered training group for track intervals. So, instead of five guys running 8 by 400 meters, it might be three guys and two girls. It was rare, since there was generally a relative gap in pace that made mixing men and women on track workouts fairly unproductive. But on occasion, perhaps because it was sprinters running with distance runners, or because a top woman on the team was doing an all-out effort, whatever the case, it occasionally happened, and it almost universally brought out the worst in the male runners in that particular group, myself included. We always ran too hard, too fast, and with far too much intent. We were, through years of gender-stratified sports involvement and spectatorship, both overbearing and defensive. For the most part, the female runners were generally unfazed. They usually simply wanted to get in a fast workout, although I do think some took a certain joy in challenging the men's team, particularly since our women's program was far more successful nationally than our men's. Such a long introduction leads me to the case of Lindsey Vonn, the long-standing champion downhill skier who is currently petitioning the International Skiing Federation to compete in the men's division at the 2018 World Cup Alpine Downhill event. While the Federation hasn't said yes, they didn't say no either, which, if you have kids, you know is virtually the same thing. They'll hold a hearing next calendar year for a verdict, but for now, it's certainly in the realm of possibility. Unlike many sports, it's reasonable to predict how Vonn may fare, as men and women often compete on the same course. While she wouldn't win, she'd be competitive, even if at a lower tier than her normal dominance of the women's field. That is, to be clear, an anomaly. In the sports world, there generally is a more pronounced divide between men and women atop their respective sport. There will be calls from various constituencies that this is both a vanity play and an affront to women's sports, which could theoretically suffer in the shadows of Vonn's efforts. Some of that dissent may be based on Vonn's tendencies towards self-promotion, including her seemingly too convenient relationship with Tiger Woods. I can't say whether it's better for Vonn to dominate the women's field as she has her entire career, or pursue competition with men. That's like telling someone whether they should stay in their job or go back to graduate school. And as Danica Patrick has shown, Vonn's entree into men's sports is not likely to forever change its landscape. More likely, it'll be an asterisk, more remembered for commercial appeal than athletic impression. What is interesting, though, is how this could ever so slightly alter the way we think about fair competition. We almost instinctively divide people in sport by gender, so quickly and without thought that we rarely even stop to wonder why all the girls disappeared from a soccer team. There are some sound reasons for this, many based on physiology as kids age. Yet, as Lindsey Vonn demonstrates, sports performance isn't entirely binomial, just as gender isn't as well. Perhaps Lindsey Vonn's efforts in men's sport should be a reminder that competition is competition, something that should be based on skill sets, not the at times confounding construct of gender. That, of course, would make sports, from youth to adult to spectatorship, far more challenging to our existing biases, biases that extend well outside the field of play. It's also not likely to happen, not in our current environment, but it certainly would make track practice, like mine years ago, far less contentious.
Keith Strudler is director of the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University in New Jersey. The views expressed by WAMC Northeast Public Radio, National Productions, and 51%'s commentators are solely those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the views of WAMC 51% or its management. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1473.